All right, session three on overview of the Old Testament. You should have a page there. It's actually on the series of books, Exodus through Deuteronomy.
This one here, is that?
That's it, and I think I already gave you that, didn't I?
Well, I
always wonder about you. Now, that's the one. Okay, now you're going to, as I said, those of you who are new, you're going to want to get a notebook that allow you to file these things away, because on the overview of the Old Testament, I don't have that finished yet, so I give you bits and pieces of it, plus there are quizzes, and if I give you the whole thing, you'd already be ahead of the game. So just work your way through keeping these things together with previous lessons on overview of the Old Testament or Old Testament survey. All right, last week we looked at Genesis, and really, as I was talking to Anita last night, you could spend a year on each one of these books, but we're not. We are just doing a survey. It's just like when the children of Israel went into the Promised Land. Before they went in, they sent in 10 spies to survey the land, which means they went and they got a good overview, but they didn't see every stone, and they didn't catalog every mountain and every river. They just noted the people, they noted the terrain, they took note of what they were in for when they got into the Promised Land. And that's what we're doing when it comes to looking at the Old Testament. 39 books of the Old Testament, a lot of material, a lot of history. There's no way you could look at the entire Old Testament in a lifetime. But we are just doing a survey so you're familiar with it, so you're comfortable with it, so when somebody asks you a question from the Minor Prophets, you know exactly what's going on in the Minor Prophets. Somebody talks about Ezekiel, you go, yeah. But you know, right, I know a general idea of who Ezekiel was, who he's writing to, what he's writing about. All right, so we are... some of the books during the Institute will be taught specifically, like the Book of Revelation is being taught. Right? We are working our way through Revelation, but we're doing a survey right now. Okay, so Exodus to Deuteronomy, let me just remind you, the first five books of the Bible are called the Law. In summary, Genesis means beginnings. Exodus, the exit. We talk about people making an exodus or an exit out of something. Well, there was an exit out of Egypt. Leviticus, those are the rules for worshiping God. Very, very important book to understand how God wants to be approached. It's not just any old way. It had to be through a sacrifice. It had to be through a sacrifice that was mediated through a very particular type of a person, a priest, working under in a system of priests, working under a high priest. And if anything fell through, God killed them. God wouldn't accept their sacrifice. Numbers, by its name, it means taking account. And basically, it was taking account of the people of Israel and then taking another account, as if to show they were always. It's kind of like, you know, if you got a large family and you go into a shopping mall. And then while you're in the shopping mall, you quickly do a count. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. All right, we got all the kids. Let's go on. And then later on, you go 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Two are missing. Okay. So during the Book of Numbers, they were taking counts because they were preparing to go into the Promised Land, but they never made it. So it's a book of failure, unfortunately, with some success. Deuteronomy means the second time law, not another law, but going through the law for a second generation. These were the children of the original group that came out of Egypt, and Deuteronomy was written to them to remind, to review, and to explain some of the things about God's laws. They constitute about 2,700 years of history. If you notice your timeline, creation is about 4,000 BC, the flood about 2,400 BC, still on the front page. Abraham's at about 2,000. You run down to Joseph, sold into Egypt in 1800, and it's about 400 years later, a little less, 350, when Moses shows up. Moses and the Passover, Mount Sinai, 40 years of wilderness wandering, and then finally, 1350 BC, Joshua is taking the children of Israel across the Jordan River. That's the span of Genesis to Deuteronomy.
It was 1,000 years after the flood, so...
Sorry?
Moses was about 1,000 years after the flood.
Moses? Yeah. No, Moses was about 2,500. Where do you see Moses? 1,450 B.C. Right. Oh, 1,000 years after. I didn't hear. That's right.
Is it that idea?
Yeah. No, everybody knew of Sodom and Gomorrah. The whole world knew of the flood. There are 250 flood legends by people groups all over the world. Everybody knew about it except Western Europeans. Okay, we'll move on.
I didn't think more than Joshua and I left out of the Bible.
Were that close? Did you know Noah was alive or died about the time that Abraham was born? So there's a lot of connection with the past. When Noah dies, somewhere around there, there's Abraham running around, a little baby Abraham learning about great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-grandpa Noah. Okay, so even though they didn't have a Bible at that point, there was enough influence, there was so much history. You met Noah who built the ark, okay? So there was no question on the Word of God. Now, Exodus.
Would have been dead by the time Abraham was born?
No, they cross over. I don't remember exactly the date. I'm just drawing off my memory. So they overlap just slightly. So even if Noah did die when Abraham was very young, whatever, Abraham's parents would have told him everything. But it was pretty close. Exodus, and I gave you the Hebrew, so memorize that just under there. No. You remember, in Hebrew, you read from right to left. In Chinese, you read top to bottom. All right. Key scriptures in the summary of Exodus. Exodus takes up where Genesis leaves off, obviously. In Exodus, we have the birth of a nation. Remember this stuff. The founding of a theocracy. You heard of a monarchy. A monarchy is where a king rules. A theocracy is where God rules. The giving of the law and the erecting of the tabernacle. That's what Exodus is all about. The title of the book, Exodus, describes its content, which is an outgoing or a coming out from Egypt. The theme of Exodus is threefold. Okay? The redemption of Israel from slavery. The identification of them as the people of God. They were known as the people of God, and the founding of them as a nation. No other nation has such a series of events that mark their beginning. Notice Exodus 3:12 says, "And he, God, said, certainly I will be with thee." I like, wouldn't you like to have that kind of confidence? God gives them great confidence, says, "I will be with thee. This shall be a token of thee. This is your sign that I have sent thee," talking to Moses. "When thou hast brought forth the people out of Egypt, ye shall serve God upon this mountain." So what mountain was Moses and God talking on? Mount Sinai. So the proof to Moses that God was in control was at some point they would end up back at that mountain, and lo and behold, they did. Now the outline. First thing, when you go through the book of Exodus, you have Israel in Egypt and in trouble. Pharaoh, there was a new Pharaoh who came along who wasn't friendly towards Joseph and his people. Joseph had died off, obviously, and generations had passed. And this new Pharaoh says, "I don't like all of these Jews." And he intends to control the Jewish population. He actually tries to force the midwives to kill all of the male children. They want to keep the girls. Nothing's ever changed. Use the girls, keep the girls, but kill the guys. Moses, in his capacity, gets born. And what's amazing, now, you must understand some things, you might write some of these things down. Moses means drawn out. And he was not named by
That's already written down.
I know, but I'm getting right to it. He was not named by his mother. He was named by Pharaoh's daughter. And the word drawn out is just what God is going to do with Israel. He's going to pull Israel out of Egypt through Moses. So it's just kind of unique. God was guiding the thought processes of this young lady named Pharaoh's daughter. Moses, however, did not have a perfect life. He ends up murdering a guy. He ends up being extremely full of pride and full of himself and has to be humbled as a shepherd. He didn't even have his own company. You think this super highly intelligent guy named Moses, best education in the world, would be in charge of all of the people in Midian, but no, he's working for his wife's daddy, which is a very humbling thing. God then calls Moses at the burning bush. God has to overcome a 40-year-old bad attitude. Bitter towards God. God gives him the ability to do signs and wonders. He shows him the needs of his own house first. If you remember, after dealing with Pharaoh, he meets the angel of the Lord, is about to kill him because his own children have not been circumcised yet. He had an imbalance. When he goes to the people and he expresses that God has called me to lead you out, and they ask him to prove it. He does it with the leprosy. He does it with the rod turning into snake, and the people believe. Then he stands before Pharaoh, and I believe he must have been the most confident, the most full of faith kind of guy. But as soon as Pharaoh says no, everything crumbles. And one of the greatest illustrations of human nature is as soon as something doesn't go wrong, something doesn't go right, as soon as something goes wrong, all of our faith collapses. So we let circumstances define what we ultimately believe. And Moses, you know, ultimately the people work triple hard, and their taskmasters are even harder on them. Their life becomes harder, and yet here's Moses who's supposed to be delivering them. God is supposed to be on their side. And in that life, you really believe God for something, and then it doesn't happen, and you fall flat on your face, and what does the devil tell you? Whisper in the back, that was a waste. You did give up. Don't even try that again. So, but Moses does, okay? Moses goes back, and six chapters, really, he faces off. He stays faithful facing off Moses. And let me just give you an illustration here. Right down to the left of Roman numeral 5, this is how you deal with sin. This is how you deal with Satan. This is how you deal with the flesh. You deal with it again and again and again. It's not a once-off battle and a win that Satan doesn't bow to you, okay? You've got to be faithful in doing what God told you to do, and over time, your enemy loses, okay? So while he confronts Pharaoh, he uses simple miracles, all right? The rod turned into a serpent, and guess what? Pharaoh's not impressed. But then God turns up the heat, okay? The world's not impressed with your conversion. He's not impressed that you're converted from a sinner that used to be alcohol, drugs, wife beater. You heard the phrase, you know, in the court of law. Mr. Jeremy Grindall, have you ceased from beating your wife? Well, how do you answer that, you know? If you say, no, I haven't, then you're still beating her. And if you say, yes, I have, then when were you beating your wife? You have to. Anyway, these people needed, the Egyptians needed to be brought to their knees, to be humbled, and that's why disaster is a good thing. We know those 10 plagues. You need to get an idea of these things and list them in your head, because I will ask for them on the final exam. The first one being water turned into blood. And what's amazing, Moses shows up and he turns water into blood. The first miracle that Jesus does, he turns water into wine. Now you've got water turned into blood, you have frogs coming. And you know, it's kind of, there's a great message called One More Night with the Frogs. And it is a great thought. And that when Moses is called by Pharaoh to come and get rid of the frogs, Moses says, okay. And then Pharaoh says, hold on, hold on. And he's very proud. And he doesn't want to be too humble. He says, do it tomorrow, not tonight. And it's like, I'll take the frogs one more night because I don't want to act like God is in control. I can take my trouble a little bit longer before God gets rid of it. I don't know if you understand that. But it's really cute when you see human nature, how stubborn we are. Lice, flies, can you imagine put up with lice for days and days and days? Flies, the murrain, which was a plague or a disease on their livestock, boils everywhere, including on the cattle, hail mixed with fire, locusts, darkness, and then finally the death of the firstborn. Only with that last one does Pharaoh finally break. Now you hit chapter 12 and chapter 13, then at midnight, as soon as the cry goes forth and all of the firstborn are dead, because if somebody did not have the blood of a lamb on their doorpost, the death angel would kill the firstborn in that home. So the cry of the land, at that point Moses is called by Pharaoh, and Pharaoh says, get out. And at that hour, they all gather their things, just as God promised, and they head out of Egypt at midnight. When they head out, they did it without a single shot, without a single battle, no swords. They were slaves. How could they fight? So this was the greatest event. And you know, when you got saved without a single battle, without a single shot. You got saved. You defeated your sin record. You defeated the devil. You defeated your flesh when you finally surrendered to the blood of the Lamb. Now, and you walked away free. So, the journey begins. An entire nation is born in one day. And just because of the substitute of a lamb. But things aren't always hunky-dory for very long. As soon as they walk for a few days, they come to the Red Sea, and they're boxed in. And that's their first test. Their first test is, will they go forward? And the challenge of the Christian is always to go forward. The direction that God called you, stay with until He changes the direction. Don't let an ocean stop you. Don't let a mountain stop you from going where God has called you to go. So at the Red Sea, God makes a path through the sea. And if you'll take note, Exodus actually is showing you the life of the Christian. As soon as you get saved, the next thing you need to do is get baptized. 1 Corinthians chapter 10 tells us that them going through the Red Sea was a picture of a Christian going underwater and coming back out of the water and never going back to Egypt. Okay? 1 Corinthians chapter 10. After they go through the Red Sea, the journey continues, and there are more tests, as you well know. They get thirsty at the waters of Marah. They're bitter waters they can't drink, and yet God miraculously provides with a tree being thrown into that water. Manna and quail, instantly starting off all of the old bread that they had brought out of Egypt, had been eaten. And it was time for God to do something, and then for the next 40 years, God every day supplies them with bread. Then they come to a rock, they run out of water again, and Moses strikes the rock, and there is water from the rock. Victory over a very vicious, one of the most vicious enemies in the area is called the Amalekites. Moses' father-in-law shows up in chapter 18 of Exodus and gives some advice, because Moses is working his tail off, trying to judge and help and guide and counsel 1.5 million people who queued up all day long with questions. Imagine 1.5 million Westons. Can you imagine just coming up, and he was just wearing himself out, and his wife's father says, Moses, I got a word of advice for you. Now you pray about it, see if God wants you to do it, but let me give you some advice. Get you some help. Look out and among the people and find 70 men who will take the easier cases, and you take the harder ones. And this is how governments operate, okay? You have local representatives, and then you have higher government that make bigger decisions and deal with bigger problems. And that's how churches operate, too. You have a pastor, but you have elders, which are called, same thing from the Old Testament, who deal with problems that they can deal with. And it's called delegation. And it's great advice.
You said this is a picture of the Christian life?
Yes. Yes. Everything that was written in the Old Testament was written for our learning. It wasn't just a nice story. Roman numeral 9. Then God begins to instruct His people. He begins the law. They find themselves at Mount Sinai. Children of Israel had not been there. They come to it, and this is where God has spoken to Moses, and God continues to speak to Moses. And when they get there, remember, it became dark, and there was thunder and lightning, a loud trumpet blast. The people couldn't stand the sound. And Moses goes up and by himself listens and talks to God. And God, with his own finger, carves out the Ten Commandments. You are given then after the Ten Commandments, you have what are called three groups of law. Remember, do you need a pen, John? Okay. You've got to remember there are three kinds of laws. There is civil, ceremonial, and moral law. Civil laws are laws on how a government should operate, how they operate justly and fairly among all its people, what ought to be expected by a society and by the people in general. There is ceremonial law, which is the laws of worship, and then the moral laws. And those are how we treat each other. Those things have never changed. The civil laws have not changed as far as God is concerned. The ceremonial laws, however, at the cross, were nailed and left there. Right? Jesus is our only needed way to get to God. And the Old Testament is a different way. So the ceremonial, the civil and moral laws, God gives specific instructions on how to build an altar there at Exodus. He deals with slavery. He deals with the death penalty. How you deal with personal injury. Somebody hurts you. How do you deal with that? Property damage. These all sound like very modern issues. Again, more issues on the death penalty. Taking care of the poor. Religious duty. So on and so forth. Then he talks about the tabernacle. A key focus of the life of the people of God was worship. Yes, Nita?
You said only the ceremonial laws had been away.
At the cross, yes. I am. The plans of the tabernacle, the centerpiece, and it ought to be of our life, the centerpiece of the life of Israel was the worship of God. So you have the plan for the tabernacle built. And so these are all given to Moses. God actually scrolls back heaven and gives him a look at the tabernacle in heaven. He says, now build an altar just like that one. Build a candlestick just like that one. Make you an altar of incense just like this one over here. And he's showing him what's in heaven. So now this is a great picture. When Moses was laying out the tabernacle, he was building a little taste of heaven. And our church.
Was that the actual place in heaven, or was it just an envision of the rest of
it? It was a vision. Well, do both. It was a vision of what it looked like in heaven.
Yeah, but where he saw it, like, say he saw it 100 yards up.
Well, he just saw it in the sky. It says he saw it. He could see it. But our church ought to be a taste of heaven. Everything we do ought to be like it would be in heaven. Okay? Then we have the golden calf miraculously appears. Where is Moses at this time? He's up on Mount Sinai. Where are the children of Israel? Down at the bottom, waiting. They wait for 40 days. You know how hard it is to wait and do nothing for 40 days? Mm-hmm. 40 days. So somewhere around in there, Aaron and all the people are talking, and somebody says, hey, Aaron, you're a silversmith, you're a goldsmith, aren't you? Why don't you make us a god? That's it. They've been making gods all their life when they were growing up in Egypt. And everybody took their earrings off, everybody took their hand rings off, their bracelets, and they gave them to Aaron. Aaron melted it down. All within a few days, he makes this huge monstrosity of a cow. I could find other things to worship besides a cow. But the golden calf, huh?
How could they think a cow was a god?
I don't know, but that was a lot of the religions, the centerpiece of their religions was a cow. For Egypt, they worshiped beetles. They carried beetles. It was like a charm and an amulet.
Egyptians.
A lot of their influence was Egyptian, and a lot of the Baal worship, all of the satanic worship was a cow. If you remember, one of the types of Lucifer, Satan, his feet are ox feet. And I'm not sure of all of the connections, just believe me, I can think of a better thing to make to worship than something that has an udder. No, the idea is they gave it to him and he fashioned it, so he must have been beforehand. All of these guys were very well trained in certain, they were tradesmiths of some sort. Since he was good at this, he must have been a goldsmith or a silversmith. Golden calf appears. What's funny is when Moses confronts him, what does Aaron say? No. I just threw the gold in the fire and out came this calf. I mean, you know, human nature, here's a grown man, and I just don't know how it got here. People are funny. All right, Roman number 11. Moses goes up on Mount Sinai for a second time. After all of this, God says, "I think I'll destroy Israel." And Moses says, "Let me take care of them. These are your people, God." And this is Moses. This is where Moses says, "I don't think I'll be able to handle these people if they're going to be like this. If you don't show me your glory." And so God shows him. Remember, he passes by him. He covers him until he passes by, and then he sees, you know, the tornado effect of him passing by. Thought you turned that off. All right. Now, so Moses go back up on the second, up to Mount Sinai second time. He's now gone 80 days without food. And you know what's amazing? You know, when you're really caught up with God, when you're really caught up even in a project or whatever, you don't think about eating. And when he comes down from that second time being with God, he is shining. So fasting is good for you, especially if you're walking with God. Fasting's very healthy. But if while you're fasting, you're walking with God, I think it'll make your face shine. I think your relationship with the Lord will show. They should be, no, the best way, the best way the best way to fast is to do it with God. Some people fast just for health. Maybe they're struggling with the flu or whatever, and they go, "Listen, I'm just going to purge my system." Okay? All right, that's a health issue. So they fast. But that's not going to make your face shine. That's not going to change your life. But if while you're fasting, you walk with God, okay? Or if while you're trying to walk with God, you decide, "I'm going to fast too," then what you're doing is you're bringing both things together, and that makes the best type of a kickstart for your relationship. You don't fast 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year. You'll die. But if you need to kickstart that relationship, you get alone with God, you cut off the food, and you just stay with God, then it affects you, okay, for good. Then they build the tabernacle. All of the different issues there, you'll see on your back page, you'll see some diagrams of the tabernacle, and you can refer to that. There are 7 pieces, 7 parts to the tabernacle. That includes the main altar, the middle. If you'll notice the middle diagram there, you have a huge altar, a burning altar, which they placed the lambs after they had been slain, after the blood had been drawn out. They then would pass by, you'll see a huge bathtub called a laver. We use the term now laboratory, where they wash their feet and their hands and their bodies. And then when they went into the holy place, which is the tent inside of the tent, there would be an altar of incense, a table of showbread, and a huge golden candlestick with 7 candles on it. But then as you passed by that, you went further into the Holy of Holies, where you had Ark of the Covenant, which had the Ark of the Covenant, meaning the container of the 10 Commandments, had a pot of manna in it as well, and it had a mercy seat. And that's where they sprinkled the blood on that mercy seat 7 times, and they would be able to declare, "It is finished. People are forgiven." And also on the bottom, you have a chart that shows where the area was that Israel came out of when they lived at first, before they became slaves, in the most fertile area of Egypt. But they became slaves. And then God had to bring them through the Red Sea, down to Mount Sinai, and then for 40 years they wandered in circles in the wilderness. And you see where that area is. And then up until they headed into the Promised Land up at the top of the page. All of that is an aerial shot from a satellite of the Middle East.
What was in the Holy of Holies?
What was in the Holy of Holies? The Ark of the Covenant, covered with, which was a box, and the top of the box was called the Mercy Seat. Leviticus. Inside the Ark were 10 Commandments. Were the 2 tables of stone. Alright, as far as Leviticus was written to show Israel how to live as a holy nation in fellowship with God. And thus to prepare that nation for the high service of mediating. This was a nation of priests. They were to mediate the redemption of God to all the nations. Now, they weren't very good at it, but during Solomon's day, they did pretty good because the whole world heard of the God of Solomon during his lifetime. The Queen of Sheba came all the way because she heard of this incredible nation. Above all, then, Israel must be taught the holiness of God, and Leviticus reveals this in three ways. Through the sacrificial system, which insisted that without the shedding of blood, there is no remission. God says in Leviticus 17:11, I have given you the blood as an atonement, the blood of the Lamb as an atonement for your sin. And you know, when you see the sacrifice of the Lamb and you understand the death of something innocent and something sweet and soft for you, you realize, even the hardest of hearts realizes, my sin is awful. Okay? Secondly, Leviticus shows the precepts of the law. They showed that there is one divinely revealed standard for all character and conduct. When you look at Leviticus, it defines what is holy, what is good, and that we all fall short. Amen? And three, and it also, Leviticus shows the holiness of God in the penalties attaching to violations of the law, which sternly proclaim the inflexibility of divine holiness. So what does that mean? It means God's not up for debate. You either come to God His way or you don't make it. Okay? Perhaps as the first simple step toward understanding the message of Leviticus is to appreciate the first words of the chapter, and the Lord called unto Moses and spake unto him out of the tabernacle. Now, this is amazing. God has spoken out of heaven before. And in Leviticus, now God's talking right there in their midst. He had changed address, and He spoke to them straight out of the tabernacle. Before this, a distant God had spoken from the mount that burned with fire, from the heavens as well. But now, God, who dwells among His people in fellowship with them, speaks out of the tabernacle. Therefore, the people are not addressed as sinners distanced from God, like those of other nations, but as being already brought into a new relationship, even that of fellowship on the ground of a blood-sealed covenant paid for by the blood of the Passover lamb. This is the point at which Leviticus begins. In Genesis, we see God's remedy for man's ruin. A Messiah, the seed of the man, the seed of the woman. In Exodus, we see God's answer to man's problems, man's cry, slavery of sin, and that is by the blood of the Lamb. In Leviticus, we see God's provision for a man's need, which is a priest, a sacrifice, and an altar. It is from this that Leviticus gets its name. Israel's priests were the Levites. And the word Leviticus comes from the Greek Levitikos, which means that which belongs or pertains to the Levites. So it's kind of like a book for the Levites. With good reason, Leviticus holds the central place among the five books of Moses, for with its doctrine of mediation through a priest, forgiveness through a sacrifice, and reconciliation at the altar, it is the very heart of the Pentateuch, and it's the heart of the gospel. Okay? There is no gospel without the holiness of God being satisfied by the blood of the Lamb. Amen? All right, out. Sorry. Out of the very Holy of Holies is where God spoke. Okay. Outline of the events. God describes five sacrifices. And and then the priestly responsibilities in handling those sacrifices. And the sin offerings, the guilt offerings, peace offerings, grain and offerings. Then Leviticus shows the ordination of Aaron and his sons. I want you to understand, the Levites were a tribe. And the Levites by birth were supposed to be priests. They were supposed to take care of the tabernacle, supposed to take care of the worship of God. By birth, they just, you know, when they come to realize that, you know, I'm a Levite, all right, your job, that is your job, whether you want to be, now that also meant they were farmers, also meant they raised cattle, but their calling in life, and this is something very important, from birth, their calling was predetermined. Okay, they were going to do that, whether they want to be an artist or not. Sure, you can be an artist if you want, but that's on the side. Your main goal, your main design is to take care of the tabernacle, take care of helping the people worship God. Aaron, however, being the brother, the older brother of Moses, Aaron and his children were destined always to be the high priest. So everybody who is a high priest throughout time until Christ, all were descendants of Aaron. Okay, so you got to understand those two lines. Now, there were problems and warnings for priests, and that was how they took care of the office of the priesthood. Nadab and Abihu were killed on the spot for not handling things correctly in the tabernacle. And they fooled around, they played with what was called strange fire. They took in, you know, in a candlelight service at church, instead of candles, you gave everybody firecrackers, you know? And that would be very disrespectful. First to God, secondly to the people who came to worship. And so God killed them. And as these guys were slaughtered, I mean, can you imagine Aaron, his own two boys were killed because they just didn't take it seriously what they were supposed to be doing. But the warnings were given, you take me seriously, God says. Then the Day of Atonement, and that is a yearly event where all of Israel was forgiven for a year of their past sins. And their sins were rolled back for a year. Now, if they neglected to come and offer a lamb and be a part of the sacrificing of one lamb for the nation, if people sort of stayed back, then they died in their sins. God held them responsible. Then God describes the holy life, and it is quite a list of things about how to eat meat and what kind of meat and the prohibition from blood. There was no blood pudding to be eaten at all. They even dealt with sexual conduct of how God expects you to respect the marriage. And between the priests, they were not to be divorcing, and they weren't supposed to be marrying somebody who was divorced. And in general ways, just how what it meant to live a holy life. And it'd be amazing, you know, these the Roman Catholic priests. It'd be very interesting to get them to sit down and find out if they claim to be a priest, if they claim to have a tabernacle, if they claim to have a bloodless sacrifice, but it still is a sacrifice, and if they claim, let's compare them with the Old Testament and see if they match, and they don't match one all. And it'd be a real good thing if you ever could get a book called Two Babylons by a guy named Alexander Hislop. And if you could compare the Roman Catholic system with the Old Testament system, Old Testament priests and their worship of God, and then compare it with the Babylonian priest system and their worship of their God. And you find the Roman Catholic system with all their priests and everything else, they match up with Babylonian religion far better than they do with the Old Testament priest system. Oh, they have to use some words and they have to use some similarities to make them look biblical, but they're more Babylonian than they are Old Testament. All right, so you have a diagram of the high priest there wearing a breastplate. You know, it's this huge, beautiful board on their front with 12 very precious stones reminding him of the 12 tribes of Israel. Again, in Leviticus, because life is precious, God talks about crimes that deserve capital punishment. What is capital punishment? What does that mean? The death penalty. Somebody who sacrificed their children to unknown gods to sacrifice means to kill. They would actually put their children in a fire and burn them up to the god of Molech, and that was worthy of death.
Molech, Babylonian god.
Molech was not a Babylonian god. He was some. I'm not sure. Molech was some sort of a. All of the countries had altars to Molech. It is a really strange thing. This thing was a very evil-looking god who had his hands out, and underneath his hands was a burning fire of coals, and his hands were like this, and you'd place a baby right on that thing, and that baby would be incinerated. But they would give their children to this idol. And God said, a parent does that, those parents die. Don't even think a second thought. When you turn to people who turn to mediums and witches and palm readers and all that stuff, they turn to witchcraft and warlocks. They die. Even here's a 16-year-old and he publicly curses his parents. Whew. Bible says stone him. You wouldn't have too much rebellion if we could do that, huh? We all be dead too. You know that. Sexual crimes. Certain sexual crimes were killed. Stoning. Stoning. Sexual crimes. Rape. and spiritualism and witchcraft, again, reminding those people these things deserve capital punishment. Specific laws concerning the priests, things that were that all priests had to be careful of, things specifically for the high priest to stay away from, how to sacrifice, so on and so forth, all of these details, and then the festivals. A Sabbath day was a time for worship. The Passover and Unleavened Bread. The Feast of Weeks, which is what we call Pentecost. The Fall Sabbath, a special harvest Sabbath. Day of Atonement. And the Feast of Booths, which is what they call the Feast of Tabernacles as well. Each one of these things type or show an area in the Christian life that needs to be developed. Leviticus and the Old Testament has got great lessons. We're not going to go through it. I'm not even going to begin. I'm just giving you outlines, just giving you a taste for them. Then you know something called the Sabbath year. Everybody was a farmer. You had to farm in order to live. Your dad would be excited to be back in those days there, Nico. But everybody was a farmer. But you had this, you say you had 10 acres of land and you had been farming it for 6 years. At the seventh year, you let it rest. Now that's why you actually divided the land into smaller sections and you alternated. You had 1 year you had 4 acres that were planted. The next year you had 7 acres. Next year you had 9 acres. But then after 7 years, you went back to those first 3 acres or 4 acres and you let them rest and you just harvested the other land. So there was always, every bit of land always was governed by a 7-year plan. That's called planning. It's called taking care of your crops. Now what that did was, everything that just grew would then die again and replenish the land and allow it to regenerate. Sometimes you just need rest. The Jubilee year was after 49 years. Say Paul takes a loan out for a house in the 36th year of what they call the Jubilee schedule. So on the calendar of years, of 50 years, on the 36th year, he buys a house. And what has to take place is that he may get a 20-year loan. But by 14 years later, on the 50th year, all loans are forgiven. Wouldn't that be cool to buy a house on the 49th year? Nobody would sell you a house on that year, believe me. Yes?
You have 70th year to be landed.
I should say, it is the Jubilee year. It is seven sevens. It's the 70th year. I said 50, sorry. 70th year. It is seven sets of seven. I'm strange here. Let's go look at it. Let's go look at chapter 25. Leviticus 25. Well, one mistake. Let us count the years to the sale. Will be able to restore it to remain in the hand of him until the year of Jubilee. Sorry?
52
I don't know. Yeah, well, it's using the term Jubilee, but I want to know whether it's 50 or 70.
Twenty-five ten.
She hallowed the 50th year. It's 50. John, why didn't you see that?
On the wrong page.
You're on the wrong page. All right. 50th year, that's right. 7 times 7 is 49. That's where the number should be, not 7 times 10, 70. 7 times 7 is 49, and then after that, the next year was the 50th year. And what this meant is that if somebody was so in debt even that they had made themselves a slave to somebody else, they could go free. And on the 50th year, all debts were forgiven. Everything, say I even lost my house because the bank repossessed my house, so I couldn't own it. The bank would only keep it for 10 years, 15 years, until the year of Jubilee, and then it all went back to the original owners. Well, it was a great restoration. It was a great time of rejoicing. Yes?
So what does Jubilee mean?
Jubilee just means rejoicing. Okay. The book of Numbers. The Hebrew name for this fourth book of Moses is Be-Midbar. You don't have to know that, but he needs to know that the Hebrew name means in the wilderness. And that's just from the first words of the first verse. The Greek name is arithmoi, where we get the word arithmetic, okay? Which in Latin becomes numeri, and that's where we get the word numbers. The book being so named because in it the children of Israel are twice numbered. Once at the beginning of the book and again towards the end. Numbers resumes where Exodus left off. There's a break of just 1 month between setting up of the tabernacle in Exodus and the command to number the people at the beginning of Numbers. So Leviticus instructions coming in between the two. So Leviticus is sort of like an instructional booklet, and you've got Exodus being a lot of instruction, but it's a lot of history. You have some instruction, then you're back to a story. You're back to the history of Israel. Numbers covers the period of Israel's history from the second month of the second year. God bless you, after they left Exodus. And remember, their new year began when they left Egypt. That was the beginning of their life. And my new year begins June 15th. That was the start of my new life on the 15th of June. So every year, that's my new year. Now, yeah, the normal secular new year is January 1st. But my new year, the year where I go back and I reflect when I got saved and God started my living, was on the 15th of June.
Their new year began when they left Egypt?
When they left Egypt, which we call sometime around March or April, the Passover. And in Exodus, it goes all the way to the 10th month of the 40th year. So the second month of the second year, so it lasts 38 years. Numbers covers a period of time of 38 years. Effectively, you're dealing with 40 years of wilderness wanderings, is what it comes to be. But Numbers only deals with 38 years. Again and again, the contents of the book of Numbers is referred to in the New Testament. The Holy Spirit has called special attention to it in 1 Corinthians chapter 10, talking about how stupid and evil the mind of Israel was when they left Egypt, and how they always wanted to go back, and how they always wanted to play around with sin, and how God had to judge them. But then, notice these words, all these things happened unto them for ensamples. Now, the word ensample is meaning a type or a shadow, as an illustration to us. The things recorded in Numbers are made immortal by their having been divinely resolved into types for our own learning, which means whatever happened to them, God says, now I want you to learn from that. Okay? And this goes even further. Other references include our Lord referring to the serpent in the wilderness being lifted up. So when Jesus, just before the great John 3:16 and John 3:14 and 15, Jesus says, even as a serpent was lifted up in the wilderness, so must the Son of Man be lifted up. That whosoever believeth on him should not perish, but have eternal life. For God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son. And so verse 16 comes in after a reference to the book of Numbers. So, order of events. First census, first counting of Israel. Then specifically of the tribe of Levi. Then you get some laws again, dealing with uncleanness, how to handle lepers, adultery, and those who have wronged one another. Then laws dealing with Nazarites. Now, a Nazarite is somebody who makes a vow to God and says, God, I need such and such. I need a wife. So I'm going to become a Nazarite for the next 2 years. And I'm going to dedicate myself totally to you and to doing your will. But I'm looking for you to meet my need through that Nazarite vow. Now, not everybody did that. But it was open to you. Okay, and these are the laws concerning a Nazarite. The closest thing you would have it would be a monk or a nun who would say, I'm going to go away, cloister myself, and become something. And it's kind of sad because that thing's done away with. The last Nazarite was John the Baptist and probably Jesus, although it doesn't say that he was a Nazarite, but he probably fulfilled the law of the Nazarites. Sorry?
And I thought he wasn't a Nazarite, he was a Nazarene.
He was a Nazarene from Nazareth. But not a Nazarite. But I don't doubt that he fulfilled all of the requirements of being a Nazarite. That's what I'm just saying.
Even the long hair?
Hmm?
Even
Actually, no, I don't think that. I think, however, let me just say, see, one of the signs that you were a Nazarite, let me just explain what I'm talking about. One of the signs that you were a Nazarite was you didn't cut your hair, which means during that time you were not more holy than anybody else, but you were identifying, listen, I can't go to your parties, I can't eat with you, I'm separated unto God for a little while. So that's what it meant. But there was a higher expectation of the life of that Nazarite. And I think Jesus didn't fulfill the expectation just of the common man, but the Nazarite was of a holier order, meaning that he couldn't even touch raisins, much less grapes or anything, much less alcohol, or even grape juice, wine. So I think he was fulfilling the requirements, except for he didn't cut his hair, because nobody thought of him as a Nazarite. Nobody looked at him and went like a Nazarite, but he lived the life of a Nazarite, sorry, of a vow unto God. That's right, he ate and drank with sinners. Yeah, that was my opinion. I'm not sure. He was so perfect. For example, when he was walking through the fields of corn, his disciples on a Sabbath, his disciples took the corn of wheat and the corn of grain, and they were rubbing it in their hand and they were making a dough, and they were eating it. Jesus didn't. And there was no problem with them doing it, but Jesus even kept himself from the appearance of what might be evil. So he lived at a very high plane. He lived to perfection. So that's my conclusion, but I'm not exactly fully tested out my theory.
Was he always finishing the law rather than, completing it when he got up on the cross? You know what I mean?
I think I know what you mean, but I don't know if that's necessary.
Just like that.
No, I don't think he wrapped it up. Because I think the only time he could fully... Everything Jesus did was still under the law until the cross. He didn't wrap up the Sabbath at that time. Right? He was just trying to get people to realize they had made the Sabbath bigger than it should have been. And he was trying to pull it back to where it should be. But when he died on the cross, he removed the requirement of Sabbath in order to approach God, in order to worship God. Okay. They build the tabernacle, they dedicate the tabernacle, the fire of God falls and is blessed, and God says, this is great. They then begin to travel through the wilderness. And what is amazing, every single day they woke up, there's a cloud in the sky. One cloud.
Pillar.
A pillar. So this thing, now when it says pillar, there was this, if you can imagine a pillar of fire, it was a round base hovering in the sky, and then it went up into the atmosphere, higher, higher, higher. It was like a condensed storm cloud, just over there, and this thing, and that thing would move. And they go, guys, it's moving, and they would have to pack up and catch up with the cloud. But at night, the cloud became a fire, and it just hovered there. It was like a nightlight, always burning, always reminding. If somebody woke up, oh, the fire's there. God's still with us. God's still guiding us. So for 40 years, God stayed with his people. So they travel cloud by day and a fire by night. Now, through it all, lots of rebellion, lots of struggles, as you see. Just quickly moving on. Another mistake. Should be Aaron and Miriam. See, I put that in there to test you, and you passed. John, I want to see you after class.
Miriam. Aaron and Miriam. Miriam is right, huh?
Who?
Yeah.
No, they were brother and sister.
Brother and sister.
Yeah. All right. Then you have that bronze serpent being I made that stand out. The other one should be shoved over to the left, but the making of a bronze serpent, that was very critical for next page on page the complaining. If you look it over and over and over and over, huh?
I just told the next
Roman numeral. Yeah, Roman numeral 7. What was it that stopped Moses from getting into the Promised Land? Okay, that's called he disobeyed God. But what got him to think he could disobey God?
Anger.
Anger. There on N, it's, Moses gets angry and blatantly disobeys God. He strikes the rock, and then God says, sorry, you're not going to be able to go all the way into the promised land. Aaron, why doesn't Aaron get in the promised land?
Because of the calf.
That's right, because of making that calf. Yeah. Yes.
God commanded him to strike the rock.
No, the second time. This is the second time. God says, speak to the rock. And he says, show them. And in order to show his might, Moses' might, in his anger, he strikes the rock and nothing happens. So he rears back and he hits the rock again. He says, see? But all he is in the flesh. He's, God says, Moses, that's my job, not yours. You blew it. And it's a scary, scary truth. Israel struggles with idolatry. You got Balaam and his talking donkey. Still more and more details. And then the vows. And women, well, we got to move on very quickly. Military victories, so on and so forth. And then they prepare in numbers to enter Canaan. They actually come all the way to the very coast of Canaan. Lastly, go to Deuteronomy. We learn by repetition. So God repeats the explanation of the Ten Commandments that he first gave in Exodus. The book emphasizes two things. That obedience will always equal blessings, good things from God. And disobedience will always equal trouble from the Lord, chastening. And Jesus loves this book. He quotes from it when he's being tempted by Satan. He quotes from it throughout his ministry. He loves this book of Deuteronomy. This book reminds Israel and all Christians of five things. Number one, of their past slavery to Egyptians and to sin. That's what Deuteronomy reminds them of over and over and over. Remember when ye were in bondage. Secondly, it reminds us of God's judgment on our enemies. How God judged Egypt with the 10 plagues. How he judged Pharaoh at the Red Sea. How he judged sin at the cross. 3. Deuteronomy reminds Israel and us of God's special care, feeding the Jews daily and taking care of us. 4. Reminds us of the giving of God's law at Mount Sinai. The giving of the entire Bible miraculously. 5. Reminds us that the battle for sin was won by the Passover lamb, but the battle for maturity is won by us in the promised land. Okay? So I can get sin taken care of, but my own maturity and my own sanctification, my own personal relationship with God, is fought by me. Alright? He won me, now I've got to stay close to him. I've got to grow by a battle. Yes, ma'am.
That be one in the promised land or in the wilderness, though?
They died in the wilderness. They died in the wilderness.
Right,
there was no victory in the wilderness. The only victory took place by the next generation when they crossed the Jordan River by faith and they went into battle. And then they became mature. That was when they started to live what they were designed to do. They were not designed to wander in the wilderness. This is a review of the previous four books. That's what Deuteronomy is. The history and the legislation of the earlier books are reviewed in Deuteronomy, but only as the basis for the words of admonition, which are now recorded. Deuteronomy is taken from the Greek deuteros, which is double or second, and nomos, which is law. In Deuteronomy, we have the second giving of the law, or rather a new expounding of it to the new generation of Israel who had grown up in the wilderness. Remember, you got children. Of the people that came out of Egypt, those children are now going to get it told to them again. Deuteronomy is not the giving of a new law, but an explaining of that which was already given. Deuteronomy is a book of transition. It marks a transition in a fourfold way. First of all, it shows the transition to a new generation, a young generation, what was called the children. For with the exception of Caleb and Joshua and Moses himself, the old generation which came up from Egypt and was numbered at Sinai had died. And a new generation was now grown up. Second, it marks the transition of a new possession. The wilderness pilgrimage was to give place to the national occupancy of Canaan. There was a transition to this new land. The wilderness pilgrimage was to give place to the national occupancy of Canaan. Third, it marks the transition to a new experience, to a whole new life. Houses instead of tents. Settled habitation instead of wandering. Instead of the wilderness diet, they were going to be given the milk and the honey, the corn and the wine, not alcoholic, of Canaan. Fourth, it marks the transition to a new revelation of God. And that's the revelation of His love. Now watch this. From Genesis to Numbers, the love of God is never spoken of. That's there. God loved Adam and Eve, or else He wouldn't have brought lambs in and killed them for them. But He never told them, I love you. Now watch Deuteronomy. In Deuteronomy, we have these wonderful words. Because He loved thy fathers, therefore He chose their seed. The Lord did not set His love upon you, nor choose you, because you were more in number than any people. For ye were the fewest of all people. But because the Lord loved you. The Lord had to delight in thy fathers, to love them. The Lord thy God turned the curse into a blessing unto thee, because the Lord thy God loved thee. Isn't that cool? While speaking of the transitory... What were you going to say? Sorry? Somebody? While speaking of this transitory nature of Deuteronomy, it is interesting to mention that just as the Old Testament begins with five historical books, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy, so the New Testament begins with five historical books, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, and Acts. But what is equally striking is that both Deuteronomy and Acts, God gives His people a second chance. That is cool. There's more to it, just giving you some thoughts. Now an outline. God in chapter 1 to 2, 3, and 4 goes back over history. Then He reviews the Ten Commandments and all the laws of God. Gives warnings to Israel about their constant tendency to rebel in chapters 8 through 11. Goes through proper worship again, how to administer justice. He then introduced the concept that you're going to have kings. And what I expect of those kings. Every king was supposed to take a copy of the Old Testament law and copy it out themselves. Not have a scribe do it, but they were to sit there and copy it all themselves. So they had their own personal copy by hand. Social legislation there, chapters 21 to 25, so many different things about how to deal with the victims of unsolved murders. Man, there's lots of video footage there for you. CSI and Kojak and all these things, movies, family laws, transvestites, how to build your house, that you weren't supposed to mix different things together, different clothing types, dealing with slavery, marriage, loans, and interest on loans, even kidnapping, so on and so forth. Lastly, instructions, Roman number 3, God gives instructions to Moses about what the children of Israel were supposed to do when they crossed the Jordan. And then Moses finally sits down, you know what he does? He takes the scroll and he writes this down, that I'm putting now the scroll into, the Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy, there's lots of scrolls probably. He puts those books, and he calls it the book. One. And yet it was five books. It was those five. But he calls it one book. That's why, guess what this is? It's called HaBiblos, or the book. That's what Bible means. So when Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy were written, they were called the book, and the book just got bigger. Amen? But he put the book into the Ark of the Covenant. And then Moses went up on a mountain where nobody knew, and there God buried him. God buried him. So nobody could come to his shrine and worship the dead body of Moses, because they would have done it. All right. You have some study questions for next week. All right.
This social...